Close your eyes and imagine dawn on a glorious late summer's day in the south of England. It's lovely, isn't it? But all this is about to change. Soon the skies above you will be alive with the sound of war, feats of bravery and sacrifice, a great air battle that will prove to be a crucial turning point in the Second World War. It is the 15th of September, 1940, the day when the Spitfire became a legend. I'm Tuppence Middleton, and this is Spitfire, the People's Plane. As the sun rises, operation rooms are coming to life. These are the nerve centres that receive reports of enemy aircraft approaching and guide Spitfire pilots to their targets. The operation rooms are staffed by WAFs, elite members of the Women's Auxiliary Air Force, smart young women like Peggy Balfour.
During my interview at Farnborough, I was asked what I would like to do in the WAF. Just anything to do with aircraft, I told the senior WAF officer. We chatted for quite a while. Then she told me she thought I should go into fighter command as a plotter and work in a sector operations room. I had no idea what that meant. Plotting? Anything to do with spying? Surely not. But fighter command sounded fine. I signed up for that at once.
Peggy plays a vital role in the defence of Britain. The country is protected by a complex system using the very latest in radio technology. It works like this. The new radar stations on the south coast of England detect formations of German bombers as soon as they take off from their bases in France. That information is instantly relayed to Fighter Command headquarters and then to a network of operation rooms where plotters like Peggy mark the movements of the aircraft on a huge map of southern England. Sector station commanders look down on these maps and decide where to send their Spitfire and Hurricane fighter planes. Craig Murray is a curator at Britain's Imperial War Museum.
It's a very skillful job and it's a very high-pressure job, constantly having to process new data coming through your earphones, changing these raid blocks, these little wooden blocks they have on the table they move around with these croupier sticks. They're updating it with the numbers, the directions, the height of the aircraft is estimated.
Peggy is well aware of the importance of her work. She's just met a boy who flies a Spitfire.
A week or two after we arrived, I went to a dance held in the sergeant's mess. I stood in the doorway of the hall in the shadows, taking stock of my surroundings before venturing in. It all looked great fun.
South of the border, down Mexico way.
The music was playing merrily and everyone seemed to be dancing happily. Then someone came over and asked me to dance with him. He was tall and I found danced beautifully. We danced and chatted and then, I remember, he called across to one of his friends.
Tubby, guess what? I'm dancing with a WAF who's asking about centrifugal force.
46 Squadron disappeared, but before they left, I got to know my first dancing partner quite well, Jack Lawson. I found he never fussed me and danced quite beautifully, completely to my liking.
He actually joined the RAF in 1929. He joined pretty much at the bottom of the rank structure.
Adrian Kerrison is a curator with the Imperial War Museum at Duxford near Cambridge. During the war, it was an important RAF base where Peggy plotted and Jack led a squadron of Spitfires.
He flew with 19 Squadron from Duxford from 1940 and was involved in most of the Battle of Britain. He was actually called Farmer by his squadron mates because he often spoke of being a farmer after the war.
The weather was lovely. The sun shone and it was warm and mild. We went for walks and visited local pubs. We talked and argued and laughed.
As their relationship deepened, war flared up all around them. The Battle of Britain was at its height. Day after day, Jack would fly his Spitfire, attacking bombers set on destroying Britain's defences, ports, radar stations, aircraft factories, and the very airfields where Peggy and her fellow plotters tracked the battle.
June and July were very busy months in ops. I received letters from Jack, written in haste, telling me how the squadrons moved around, how once his aircraft had been shot up and how lucky he'd been, and how, at one airfield they visited, they were able to make use of the swimming pool there. Lovely during the hot weather, but only once. The next day, nothing. It had been blasted to rubble, and they were off again.
German raids were taking their toll. Spitfires are being destroyed on the ground and in the air. Each day is a personal battle against stress, fear, and exhaustion.
Life was difficult enough just staying alive from day to day. That was enough. I used to worry, and his letters made me think. There seemed to be so little respite, and life was so fragile.
By September, Adolf Hitler is losing patience. The invasion of Britain is scheduled for the 20th of September and has to be launched before winter weather makes the crossing of the English Channel too dangerous. The last remnants of the Royal Air Force must be crushed.
They'd seen from their previous assaults on London that the RAF were sending up fewer fighters. So they took this to mean that the RAF didn't have many aircraft left. So they thought by launching two pretty big raids on London on the 15th that this could be the sort of final hammer blow to destroy the RAF altogether. Basically just getting the bombers to bomb London and then the fighters would take care of the RAF fighters that would come up to meet them.
It's a plan that might just succeed. In the summer of 1940, the RAF is in crisis. It isn't just the shortage of planes and pilots. There's a catastrophic clash of personalities at the top of Britain's Air Force, pitching a cautious tactician against a reckless national hero. British tactics against the Luftwaffe had until now been simple. When a formation of German bombers was spotted, two squadrons of around 20 fighters would typically be scrambled to intercept them before they reached their targets. This damage limitation strategy was now being challenged by a theory known as the Big Wing.
The idea is you can hit them with overwhelming numbers. It doesn't necessarily matter whether they're hitting your targets first or not, as long as you can damage or shoot down as many of them as you can after they leave.
This Big Wing theory is promoted by an influential squadron leader at RAF Duxford, a powerful personality who inspires love and hate in equal measure, Douglas Bader.
We dislike the iron crosses and the crooked sign of the swastika. And anyhow, who the hell were these chaps to come over into our sky and drop bombs on us, on our people?
Douglas Bader joined the RAF in 1928. He proved himself a brilliant but reckless pilot, crashing his plane and almost killing himself as he attempted some low-flying aerobatics. Both of his legs were amputated, but with a new set of prosthetic limbs, he was determined to join the war effort.
The whole point is that you've got to be positive about it, you see, and my attitude is that I'm not disabled and I'm going to kick these bloody legs around the place and make them do what I want.
Given leadership of a squadron at RAF Duxford, Bader decides to try out his Big Wing theory in the Battle of Britain, much to the irritation of the man in charge of the RAF fighters defending London, Keith Park.
We were fighting with our 11 group with our backs to the wall. This wasn't a little game. We were not in a position to try out tactical theories of this and that, big wings or little wings. We were fighting for our existence and the existence of the London and the Empire.
So it's a very efficient system that is winning. And this rogue system from Duxford is rather putting that in jeopardy. By the time they get there, often the Germans have either been and bombed it or Douglas Bader has decided to take them off somewhere else because he feels the hunting is better elsewhere. And so this gradually causes a huge deal of resentment.
As dawn breaks on September the 15th, hundreds of German fighters and bombers are readied for action on the coast of France. In England, two rival camps prepare to face them. To the south, 11 Group, based at RAF Uxbridge, is ready to use the familiar tactics of fast and targeted response. To the north, 12 Group, including RAF Duxford, is committed to the Big Wing approach, attacking the Germans with overwhelming force. Those tactics are about to be tested, along with the courage of WAF plotter Peggy Balfour and of Spitfire pilot Jack Lawson. The British Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, senses that September the 15th will be a big day. He's driven west from London to Uxbridge, where he watches the plotters mark the positions of wave after wave of German bombers.
At this point, things are pretty fraught. I think Churchill asks at one point, what kind of reserves do we have? And Park turns to me and goes, this is it. There are no reserves, this is it. So, especially with the afternoon raid, which is a massive one, well over 500 aircraft, it's tense stuff. It's this sort of make or break day, if you will. So very tense. And I think the Prime Minister would have seen that as well.
Churchill was a journalist long before he was a politician. He writes notes as he watches. These are his words from those notes.
Operations commence!
Presently, the red bulbs showing that the majority of our squadrons were engaged. A subdued hum arose from the floor, where the busy plotters pushed their discs to and from in accordance with the swiftly changing situation. In a little while, all our squadrons were fighting. The lower line of bulbs was out. There was not one squadron left in reserve.
Hostile 2-3 now being intercepted by Spitfires.
The first raiders reached the English coast at 11:30 in the morning. More than 200 aircraft head for London, and as bombs fall on railway junctions, dockyards, and even Buckingham Palace, fierce dogfights break out over the burning city.
The Dorniers didn't particularly fly tight, which was to their disadvantage. If they had done, they'd have had better firepower to beat off the fighters. But RCO went at them in a quarter attack, and more or less went through them and spread them out a bit.
Ray Holmes, British fighter pilot.
I made my attack on this bomber, and he spurted out a lot of oil, just a great stream over my aeroplane, blotting out my windscreen. Then, as the windscreen cleared, I suddenly found myself going straight into his tail. So I stuck my stick forward and went under him, practically grazing my head on his belly.
Jack Lawson, Peggy's boyfriend, was part of Douglas Bader's big wing. They arrive late to the battle, but Jack makes up for lost time.
He basically got ahead of the bomber stream that was bombing London, turned around and then launched a head-on attack at one of the bombers. He then turned around again, came behind it and fired at it again. And then the bomber started to drop out of the formation.
The first wave is beaten back, some caught by 11 group fighters before they reach the city, others shot down by the big wing as they dropped their bombs on London. But that was just the start. By 2 o'clock, the second much bigger wave, around 150 bombers and 350 fighters, is on its way to attack London's docks. 276 British fighters are scrambled to meet them.
We saw their planes coming toward us, and it seemed that the whole of the RAF was there. We'd never seen so many British fighters coming at us at once. All around us were dogfights as the fighters went after each other. Then, as we were getting ready for our approach to the target, we saw what must have been 100 RAF fighters coming at us. Where were they coming from? We've been told that the RAF fighters were very close to extinction.
Hans Sonderlind, front gunner of a German Dornier bomber.
I got lost from my squadron, and when I looked, there was not a soul in the sky. Then in the distance, I saw some Akak, and I went toward it, and I saw these waves upon waves of German bombers coming in. There seemed to be hundreds of them. And I forgot about anything else. Suddenly I found aeroplanes whizzing all around me. I'd flown smack into the middle of the fighter escort. Damn fool.
British fighter pilot George Unwin.
The big wing was actually pounced on by fighters that they didn't see. So the effect of the big wing, which was to launch 50 or 60 fighters at a stream of bombers, didn't really work out because they were bounced and everything just turned into melee. Jack Lawson, he ended up chasing a fighter over the channel, hoping to shoot it down, but he got shot up himself and then had to limp back to Falmir. He wrote at the end of his logbook entry for that day that he staggered back and just ended the entry with thank God.
56 German aircraft were shot down that day. The RAF lost 29. London's docks had been badly hit, and the Luftwaffe still had plenty of planes in reserve. So who had won? The British and their allies, or the Germans? And within the RAF, had Douglas Bader and his big wing proven their tactical superiority?
At full strength, a big wing would be about 60 aeroplanes. They find they're getting each other's way, so they have to keep stopping and pulling out, you know, in case they collide with each other.
In military terms, the 15th of September was a minor victory for the RAF, but it quickly proved to have enormous consequences.
And more than anything, it was a psychological victory. It really made the Germans sort of rethink everything. It made them postpone the invasion. And it just basically made them realize that they could not establish aerial superiority over Britain.
With the RAF still in control of the skies over England, Hitler believed that invasion was impossible. On September the 17th, it was postponed indefinitely. German attention turned east to the Soviet Union, and Britain would live to fight again. Jack Lawson and Peggy Balfour both survived the day, but a year later, Jack's Spitfire would be shot down by a Messerschmitt 109 over Rotterdam Harbour as the RAF took the battle into occupied Europe. Peggy lived until the year 2000, 60 years after the Battle of Britain. She never married.
Standing here, I suddenly knew that no one else would ever take Jack's place. For me, that was it forever. I didn't tell him, not wanting him to think about anything else but flying.
Thank you for listening to Spitfire, the People's Plane, from the BBC World Service. I'm Tuppence Middleton. The producers are Emily Knight, Alistair Cross, and Chris Ledyard. Research is by Lisa Lipman, and the commissioning editor is Steve Titherington. Thanks to our historical advisor, Dave Key, and to the archivists at the Imperial War Museum and Southampton City Council. Thanks also to the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight, to Alan Matlock, and to Rupert Rowbottom at the Nuffield Southampton Theatre. Music was by Public Service Broadcasting and Nick Thorburn. Our actors were Lee Ingleby, Helen Monk, Madeline Cross, Amber King, Wilf Scolding, Perdita Avery, and Ben Norris. And our grateful thanks most of all to the men and women who designed, built, and flew the Spitfire, the People's Plane.
This is the comb.
Ye need the comb.
The comb, no.
Need the comb.
The comb.
The comb is all about digging deep into one single African story every week.
This is like a moment. This is a day for you to celebrate.
Stories that might otherwise go underneath the radar, that might otherwise be overlooked.
You're in a hurry to get money. You just click OK and that one button lands you into trouble.
Stories about Africa and stories that matter.
I would walk into a bank for my salary only to be told that I should come back tomorrow because there's no money in the bank. So I decided just to quit. I quit.
I hope people will feel the way that I sometimes feel, where you are surprised and you come away kind of like, oh, I really didn't know that.
Why would anybody kill somebody over sand? What on earth would make sand so valuable?
That's The Comb from the BBC World Service. Just search for The Comb wherever you get your podcasts.